Welcome to the Brainy Gamer Podcast, episode 37 for September 7th, 2012. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. My name is Michael, and I am happy to have you with me, as always. This is a special episode of the podcast, special in that I recorded it to coincide with the release of a particular game, and I've never done that before. About 9 months ago, I began talking with Nels Anderson and Chris Dahlin, two frequent guests of mine on this show, about a game they were working on at the time called Mark of the Ninja. Chris shared an early draft of the script with me for some feedback, and Nels sent me a couple of builds of the game, which was cool and, you know, not something I typically do. And it quickly became clear to me that I was looking at a pretty special game that was genuinely unlike anything I'd ever played. I saw the game again at E3, and it looked really polished, and it occurred to me that it would be fun to help usher this game into the world by releasing an interview with two of its primary creators. Nels is the lead designer and Chris is the narrative designer on the very day of the game's release. So that's what I'm doing. I'm releasing this episode on the same day as Mark of the Ninja's release on Xbox Live. And I'm hoping you'll enjoy a little synergy between the two. I do think if you play and enjoy the game, and I really think you're going to like it if you give it a try, you'll find that this conversation is pretty illuminating. We discuss the development of Mark of the Ninja from its beginning. Nels and Chris do a terrific job of connecting their intentions for the game to the finally released version that you'll play. Both guys are incredibly reflective and forthcoming about their work. You'll also probably detect a little pride in their work too, which I think is really cool. They have made a game that they believe in, and that's always a little bit of a miracle. So that's the show. I hope you'll enjoy it. My thanks to Nels and Chris, and of course, thanks to you always for listening. And away we go. I am delighted to welcome Nels Anderson and Chris Dahlin back to the Brainy Gamer Podcast. These fine gents have appeared on the show numerous times, so we'll just say this episode marks the umpteenth time for both of you. How's that? Does that work?
That sounds good.
Is umpteenth accurate statistically?
Roughly.
Okay. Nels is a technical designer at Clay Entertainment, an independent game development studio in Vancouver, a studio with a penchant for stylish design. I will discuss what I mean by that in a little while, I hope. Chris Dahlin is a freelance writer living in the Boston area. He's written about games and music and pop culture broadly for publications like Variety, Edge Magazine, Pitchfork, and, of course, Killscreen, where he was co-founder and editor-in-chief. But more recently, Chris has made the treacherous transition from game critic to game creator, working as a narrative designer on several projects, including Mark of the Ninja, a stylish stealth platformer, I would say, which hits virtual shelves today. So it's actually not today, it's tonight, but we're recording it the night before the game comes out. So when you hear it, it'll be today. Hope that makes sense. a game that Nels had a little something to do with too, since it's a Clay Entertainment game. And that's really kind of why we're here. I thought it would be fun to get the two of you guys together and kind of bring you back to the podcast, really just to have a good chat, but mainly to be able to sort of celebrate the debut of the game that you've both worked on, and you know, for my purposes, you kind of talk in more detail about what the development process is like at a independent studio like Clay, and you know, you're thinking about this particular game, and just in general, kind of catching up. So, yeah. Welcome both.
This is awesome. Thank you, Michael.
Yes, thank you so much.
Of course. My pleasure. Now, one of the things I'm going to ask, might as well start with this, and maybe I'll ask you, Nels. I'm guessing this is a banter that you've had to sort of get into a certain routine with since you were at PAX. Can you tell me about Mark of the Ninja? What's the game about? How would you describe it?
Sure. So, Ninja is it is unabashedly a 2D stealth game, where you are, of course, a ninja, because if you're making a stealth game, being a ninja affords that pretty well, right? But of course, obviously, that's not how most ninja games play out. So we kind of wanted to correct that. It borrows pretty heavily from the visual style we established, even though I didn't work on them, with kind of the previous games Clay did, Shank and Shank 2. But we wanted to take those core fundamentals, like, you know, the animation and the really tight, responsive controls, good game feel, and bend it to a completely different purpose. Very specifically, a kind of systemic, player-centric, sneaky purpose. Hmm.
Now, we'll talk more about the game in detail in a minute, but we're kind of sitting here the night before the game comes out, and I've always wondered about this. I sort of know what it's like to have something on the, cooking for a while, and then you've got to show it to people, and there's this sort of sense of like, okay, here's what we made. What do you think? And yeah. I'm curious what you're feeling, what you're thinking about tonight as you're waiting for the game to sort of, rocket into orbit.
Yeah. I'm not. I'm trying not to think about it too much. I'm super, super, super happy with what we've got, more or less soup to nuts. Like, I think it's definitely at a place where I'm amazingly happy with it, so regardless of what happens, I always will have that. I'm very interested to see what people's take will be in that. Like, I mean, one, for me personally, like, this is the first game I've ever been a lead designer on, so there's a lot of me in the game. It's a style of game that I've loved for a long time. Like, I've always loved stealth games. I've talked about this a lot, but Thief is, like, one of the games that influenced me most as a designer. There's a lot of Thief in Ninja. Like, I wanted to make something that was a unique and different but substantial kind of contribution to that canon. And I kind of hope that's what folks pull out of it, I guess. I mean, it's not like, oh, I'm seeking external validation or anything like that, but it's almost self-serving in that, like, I just want there to be more interesting things in the world, right? And if I help put an interesting thing out into the world, maybe other people will see it and think about it and, react to it, and more interesting things that then I can interact with will also exist.
Sure, that makes sense. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, so... it's exciting and harrowing all at the same time. And also, I've been sending a lot of emails to everyone.
I mean, there's the business side of it. Obviously, you were at PAX, and you're having to show the game, and, there's this whole get it out there, sell it, let people know about it kind of dimension too, which must be, you don't sort of go to school for that, if you know what I mean.
No.
Yeah, so how's that gone? Is that...
good, I think. Obviously, we're a super small independent studio, right? So we don't have, like, marketing money at all. We just have boots on the ground, i.e. me and other folks, just, like, emailing and talking to as many people as we can and going to stuff like PAX and things like that. But that stuff seems like it's going good. It's just a matter of, like, making sure everyone's got what they need in terms of review codes and all that other kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, but I'm curious, Chris. Obviously, you're insulated from this a little bit in that you're not in the office witnessing a quiet chaos. Like, what are you feeling like right now?
Well, I'm just sort of sitting here picking away at, like, TweetDeck and looking at people talking about the game, and people responding to it, and people have started saying really nice things about it, and Since I've been a contractor on this, so I haven't even been to the Vancouver office during this whole time, so I have kind of a degree of objectivity. And, I've been playing builds since last September, and I've seen how it's shaped up, and I've had a really good feeling about the game this whole time. And I'm still biased, because I really want it to be successful and awesome. It felt really good, but it's sort of like, it's almost like, will people get it? Will people really enjoy it? Will they, like, really like it? Or will they be kind of like, eh? There's some suspense, but it's weird because people have been giving us good notes.
Yeah.
I'll say, like, you know, one thing we were talking about the press and everything, and one thing I've seen you do, Nels, is you, like, Michael, you were asking, like, how do we promote it and everything without a marketing budget? I mean, I think the first time we really started showing the game was at the Game Developer Conference, because it was announced, like, just, like, the week before that. And we just had, like, Jamie's, like, Mac, Jamie Chang, the founder and producer. You know, we just had, like, his Mac laptop that we were, like, walking around Moscone West and showing it to different people. And we showed it in our hotel room. On the Xbox debug unit, but like really kind of small guerrilla tactics, just mainly for like friends and people that we wanted to. And I think there were like three press appointments. And then I remember a month later we have PAX East, and you, Nels, had to sit in that booth in the press area for the entire 3 days straight with like maybe a brief break here and there. And this was, I'd never really seen this, because I mean, I knew I've been to conferences as a journalist and taken appointments and done that whole thing, and you know, people presenting their games and whatever. But I hadn't really seen the other side, which was like this spreadsheet of appointments, and there were like no breaks. I mean, there weren't even five minute breaks between them, and you're just sitting in that weird little booth with like the flimsy cardboard walls on the second floor of the Boston Convention Center, just talking to people, and it was just like.
It was cool.
Like, wow.
Yeah, it was cool, but it was also like, man, I'm very intimate with the inside of this tiny black room. Sure is like, tiny and black in here.
Well, yeah, you like, have to start over every time, right? I mean, when you introduce someone to the game they've never seen it before, you have to start every single time from the beginning.
Yeah. And obviously you don't want to sound like they're just... are a certain number of things that end up coming up over and over and over again, right? But you don't want to sound like you're just, you know, spewing some memorized marketing copy or whatever. So you have to, like, you know, just stay engaged with people. And with some folks, like, if they get into the game, they're really asking interesting questions or whatever, like, then it's really easy, right? It's just like, oh, we're just two people hanging out talking about a thing. That's cool. But, like, so a few of the opponents, people were just, like, totally stony, didn't really say much at all, and I'm just like, well, I'm just gonna keep talking because that's what I do. Oh boy,
the pen's not moving. They just have the little tape recorder and it's recording everything.
Yeah. And there was one of those in particular. I was just like, oh man, that guy must have hated it. And then afterwards, he wrote up a preview on one of the larger gaming sites, and he was just like raving about it. I'm like, well, that's really nice, but dude, you gotta give me like a hint when we were talking about it that I wasn't just like, you know, barfing into your ear about something you didn't care about at all.
It is actually pretty good when it is better practice to be the kind of stony face. I noticed the English are like really good at that, like just at being like so terminally unimpressed by everything. And not everyone, but you know, I've worked with like a couple people that sort of from England that had that ability, and I was like, that would get you very far. You could make a lot of people very nervous and talk quite a bit. Did you ever feel, you know, one thing I love is when people get into that jukebox thing where they have an anecdote for anything, and like, you know, you'll see maybe a Brian Eno interview from like the 70s and another from the 80s, and it's almost like little bits of it might be almost the same, you know, like, because he's had the answer to these questions. And there's an indie game designer that I interviewed once who told me a story about like his kid getting sick or something. I don't even remember what the story was, but like this really moving anecdote. And I was like, oh, I'm so glad he gave this to me and shared this with me. And a month later, a colleague of mine was like, oh yeah, he told you that story about the kid, right? Yeah.
Oh God.
Oh yeah, I used that at Edge. Here, I'll send you the link. And I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, it's like, but I mean, you can't help it, because you like you say, you had like 30 appointments that weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah.
I mean, God bless you for trying to keep it fresh every time.
Yeah, no, I tried. I mean, there's only so many. There's a, like, for a fixed set of questions, at least, there's only so many ways you can say, like, oh, this is the sort of stealth experience you really wanted to focus the game on. but it was like, I'd never really done that stuff at all before, right? So it was really interesting, and initially like a little bit harrowing, because I'm like, is this how people do? Like, I had no template to work from, right? I'm just like, I'm just gonna show up with this here game and talk to you about it because I think it's interesting. I hope you do too. I don't know. I mean, maybe that's good. Maybe that comes off as like it's just organic, because it is. I mean, there's not like any sort of machinations in my head about like these are the messages we're trying to. It's just like, let's talk about a thing.
Well, the game does you some big favors, I think, in that regard, in the sense that it doesn't look like any other game. I mean, I saw it at E3, and you know, we've talked about this, I've written about, lots of people wrote about this, you know, E3 was kind of like, you know, one game station after another of just sort of endless similar looking shooters, and you know, that I'm overstating it, but there's a whole lot of sameness there, and you know, you kind of just stumble upon this Mark of the Ninja game, and maybe you've heard of it, maybe you haven't, but I was hanging around that area, and there were other games in that particular area I was interested in, and you know, I'm not this is a cliche, but it stopped people in their tracks. People stopped and they saw it and they're like, what's this? And they wanted to play it. And, you know, you had various people there demoing it, but I was watching it being demoed and played it myself there, of course. And I don't know. It just feels to me like part of what you have to do these days always is differentiate yourself and in the market. And visually, I think, but also in terms of what, you know, it's a stealth platformer. You know, I haven't played 10 of those. it's, you know, it seems to me that you understood that you needed to find a place to carve out for your game that would look unique.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but the kind of the interesting thing about that is that it was never like a conscious decision to do that, really. It's just sort of like, well, you know, 2D is sort of our wheelhouse. That's what we do. It's like, oh, well, we pitched this game to Microsoft that literally, I mean, what Microsoft signed for all intents and purposes was a 2D game about a ninja. That was like it, really. Like,
it was
that's
just
what they
like
were
an
on.
Animation, right, that you guys showed. Did it even have gameplay when that first pitch?
I mean, so what we initially showed was like, it was like a video of simulated gameplay, but it was all like just video, right? It was like a mock-up or whatever. Of what like what gameplay might feel like. And weirdly, if you go back and watch it, it's actually not that far off, but there's a lot of very subtle but tremendously important differences. But anyway, yeah, so what Microsoft basically, you know, agreed to have us do was like, yeah, a game about a ninja. That's it. And then so I'm like, well, so we didn't really have any other, like, any other constraints. I'm like, well, I really like stealth games a lot. Like, really systemic, like heavily player-centric stealth games, so I want to do that. And it wasn't like an active thought of like, oh, you know, well, this is a kind of form that's never really been realized before. It was just like, oh, this is an interesting thing I'd like to do. And the fact that it just happens to be very novel and different, it's cool. I mean, I don't know if that's like a chicken and egg thing where it's like, oh, well, because this thing is novel and different, that's why I thought it was interesting, or vice versa. But yeah.
Well, I have this theory. You tell me what you think of this. That stealth games are kind of like, you know, in sort of baseball terms, you know, sort of like.
Oh, yeah, you know, I know all about baseball.
Well, no, stick with me. there's a kind of like a single A, double A kind of like minor league thing where, in other words, look at Looking Glass, for example. You mentioned Thief. I mean, here's a great example. Yeah. Look at that studio. Look at the people that came out of there. Right? I mean, Seamus Blackley and Ken Levine and Harvey Smith, Randy Smith, Warren Spector. I mean, it's a who's who. And they cut their teeth in this genre that in a certain way, if you can do that really well and make a really good game out of that, you can do a lot of things well because there's so much going on in that kind of game. So right. It's sort of like you have to learn how to play all the positions, you know, and you know, it's kind of like boot camp, so that you come out of there, if you really understand how to make that an entertaining genre, you can translate that into some other really interesting games that may not look at all like Thief looked, but have some similar principles.
Huh. Yeah. No, that's actually really true. Like, if you look at, I mean, it is kind of manifest in different ways, but things like, you know, you put a BioShock next to a Deus Ex next to Dishonored, like, they're all very systemic player-centric games. I mean, to more or less degrees across the various titles.
No, exactly.
But then, all that kind of probably does largely fall out of that Looking Glass heritage, which is cool. Even though some are explicitly stealth games, some have stealth as an option, and some, well, they're not really stealth games at all. That's interesting. So I actually just gave a talk about Ninja down at PAX Dev, which was just before PAX proper. I was trying to think through it hilariously, like in the talk, of course, I talked about Thief a lot. And then right as I'm about to start, I look in the audience and I see Mark LeBlanc is kind of sitting over on the side. And he was one of like the early Looking Glass people. Like, he did a ton of programming on Thief and like all their other stuff. So I'm like, well, I hope he doesn't think what I'm about to say is a bunch of insane nonsense.
He's just sitting there shaking his head like, no, that's not what I was trying to do at all.
Yeah, no, fortunately, I saw him in the hallway afterwards. He said, oh, no, it's fine. But yeah, anyway, I thought about it. It's probably the case that, just the experience they were trying to create with Thief, where it's like, you know, it's all about hiding and sneaking and all that. The best ways to express that is with, this really heavily player-centric, systemic type of game. And it was, I don't think it was they were trying to make that type of game from the outside. It was just like, oh, the desired aesthetics of what they were, of the thing they were trying to build is what, actually produced that type of design. But then in doing so, they discovered that, oh, holy crap, there's all kinds of richness here, right? That I think even still today, is still super, super fertile in a way that other styles of games might not necessarily be.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the shooter. It's interesting. Oh, yeah.
I mean, certainly not even necessarily shooter, but I think when you say shooter, you just mean the really linear, heavily cinematic, super scripted.
First person shooter, yeah, exactly. Green, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that, yeah, I think we can see where the end game there, again, no pun intended, is, and it's very recognizable and it's not super exciting. At least it's not super exciting to me, right? Versus I don't know where the bounds of a more really systemic player centric thing are, and that's awesome.
Yeah,
right. That's so exciting. So I hope that folks continue to push on those edges, because there's a lot of territory out there and it could have some really interesting stuff in it.
Chris, you were gonna say,
One thing I
would, oh yeah, sorry.
Just in talking about the development though, and again, so since I was playing them since September, and you guys seem to be feeling your way towards, you knew it was a stealth game and a 2D stealth game, but one thing I found interesting is, you tried a lot of things and then threw out a lot of things and tried new things. On, you could go and fight, and if you got caught by a guy, you guys could have a fist fight, and I remember both of you had health bars. The guard had this really long health bar, and you were sitting here punching him for a minute, and he'd finally go down. And in later builds, first that his health bar got shorter and shorter, and now, of course, we don't do that at all. You have to, it's much more stealth. You have sort of a chance to kill him, but it's really frantic. It's not this, this whole idea of, wearing someone down was, almost like a brawler element that came over from Shank, and then you dropped it. But it was interesting because it seemed like, it was, one really clear example of, you guys seemed to really feel your way to what this 2D stealth thing would mean, and what that would mean in terms of also making it an action game.
There was a lot of feel is a very good verb, because obviously 2D stealth games don't really exist, right? So we're how are we gonna build this thing? I have no idea, let's try some stuff out. And then a whole lot of that stuff really didn't work very well, so we kind of had to throw it away and try another thing. And this was another thing I talked about in that PAX dev talk, was kind of to get that core fundamental, really intentional type of gameplay. Why I think stealth games are interesting is that, they're games that are all about cause and effect and thinking very deliberately and understanding the game systems and all that, right? To actually get to that feel, that experience, we had to do a bunch of stuff that you normally, in 3D stealth games, you never do, right? So I kind of call that part of the talk, the five heresies of Ninja, because that's dramatic. So obviously the thing we've talked about a lot is, in Ninja, all the games, those core stealth systems are all really explicit, right? And they tend to be very binary, while in most other stealth games, you have some light meter or whatever, and it has it has this big analog space in it, so that there's potentially multiple levels of concealment mount and all kinds of things to feel out, and we just kind of scuttled all of that, where it's either you're in light or you're in darkness, and if you're in darkness, a guard won't see you unless you're right in his face, and if you're lit, he will, and that's basically it. It's the same thing with the noise, right? Where, in most stealth games, it's not visualized, or if it is, it's maybe on a mini map or something, but it's not perfect or precise, right? And again, as you guys well know, whenever noise is made, literally that radius is on the screen, and if it overlaps a guy's ears, he's going to hear it. If not, he doesn't.
I'll just say, when I first heard that you were doing that, before it was implemented, I think it was either you or Jamie were mentioning it to me, and I was like, that just seems weird. Like, it just seems so clear, so blatant or so blunt to have, like, circles on the screen. And in practice, it's actually really elegant, and it works really well with the gameplay, but it was an interesting decision.
Yeah, and it was definitely, like, a little polish thing where it was like, oh, there was a small little, like, indicator, but it was not at all representational of how big the noise actually was. It was just, like, a little gray circle that was always the same size if there was a noise made. And that was almost just, like, a feedback thing where it's like, oh, yeah, you broke a thing and made a noise. And then from there, we just kept trying different stuff and pushing on the different fronts and throwing all kinds of shit away until we got sort of to where we wanted it to be.
I think people have a general sense of what a lead designer does on a game, but maybe less of a sense of what a narrative designer does. And I'm curious, where was your entree into this project, Chris, and how do you sort of define your role?
It was a pretty specific role. You know, the job of narrative designer is interesting, because I was just talking, I've talked to some people who are, like, you know, full time at a company, and they really are the game designers who are responsible for the narrative. And that's a job where you can be, you know, involved in, like, you're in every design meeting, you're in every part, just like an audio designer or an art director would be. And maybe your responsibilities are across many products or many properties. But, you know, there are many variations on the role. My gig on this one was definitely, like, it was pretty clear. It was like I was brought on as a contractor to write the script for the game. And, you know, there are other games that'll do this, like, and maybe it's like someone from Hollywood who's doing it, or someone else, ugh, you know. you know, which you know, so the basically, though, it's sort of like, all right, well, we need text in these places. We got some cutscenes, we got some audio logs, we got some instruction text. Just hire someone. They sit down and they bang it out. And that was basically my, you know, what I was hired to do. But I had the privilege of, like, being so involved with it over the months of getting those builds and sort of, like, seeing things evolve, that it was a little easier to maybe adjust some of the things I was doing to the way the game was shaping up, to how the levels were fleshed out. And maybe help in other ways, like including going to PAX East and staying at the booth for a while. The interesting thing about this game is that the story came from the beginning. Like, I want to make that clear, because I don't want anyone to, you know, I wrote a script to a scenario that had already been mapped out. So when Nels approached me, you know, the story overview document at the time had, like, the lead characters, it had the plot broken out all the way to the end, it had the tattoos and the poison ink, or the hallucinogenic ink and everything. And from there, the plot of the game changed over the months a little bit. You know, we knew what all the story beats were, but we were, like, tweaking a few things. We had a couple really good story meetings where we, like, fleshed out cutscenes and talked about the ending. You know, I remember having this, like, 2.5-hour call over Skype. Everyone was in the office in Vancouver, and I was on Skype and trying to figure out, man, what exactly do we want to do with the ending? And some really cool things like that. And, you know, just fleshing out just all the other little bits of text and the audio logs and what have you. I mean, I think that the interesting thing about, I don't know, I mean, they were all interesting. I think some of the most rewarding parts are trying to write to those level. And the hardest part is trying to write to the level, like trying to figure out, okay, we know that Ninja's going to be moving around and have these kinds of obstacles. We want to have incidental dialogue. You know, Aura, who's the secondary character that's with him through most of the game, or with him through the entire game, but she's not always on screen. We want her to be saying things to him, and sometimes they're to set the tone, sometimes they're to help further the story, sometimes they're just information. And it was challenging to try to, you know, come up with those lines, sometimes even before the level was written. Sometimes you just overwrite a little and then you don't end up using it, but then you come up with something else that works somewhere else. But that's, I guess that's sort of like narrative design, because you're sort of thinking, I mean, my favorite parts of the game now are, and there's an early part in World 2, when they first are in the castle in Eastern Europe, there are a sequence of things that Aura says to you that are there to help the story, and they ended up just fitting so well with, like, the way the level flows, with, like, the mood and the kind of gloom and the environment and everything else that's going on, and it just I just was so, it wasn't like the quality of the lines even or any of that. It was just sort of like everything just fits so well. And I was like, oh, this is so great that the words are just part of this texture, but they're helping advance this thing. I would say like the other interesting thing about the story was, you know, we spent a lot of time working on it and making sure just, you know, the couple plot points that hadn't quite been figured out, you know, we all made sure that they worked and that, you know, if I sat down like I did at a bar a week ago, if I sat down with someone and had to explain beginning to end what goes on in the game, that it all makes sense, that it all adds up, that there isn't any moment of like hand waving and like, I don't know, he wanted to get in touch with his feelings. Anyway, he goes and does this other thing. You know, everything that goes on makes sense and adds up at the end, I think. But the other way to look at it is that the story also has to work for people who are paying like kind of almost no attention. You know, if there are people who aren't really listening to the cutscenes, or there are people who are just sort of like playing and they're really focused on the gameplay, you still want to give them the impression of the key points, which are, you know, your situation changes through the game. And it starts out and you're like, oh, you're from this clan and you've got to go get this bad guy, Karajan. So, okay, go get the bad guy. And that takes you through maybe the first third or half of the game. And then different things happen after that. The story is still important because it's supposed to cast that mood. It's supposed to make you feel vulnerable in certain ways, empowered in certain ways. It's supposed to make you feel lonely, or it's supposed to make you feel heroic or successful or endangered. And all those moods have to come through, and that's through all of it. That's through the gameplay, that's through the level of difficulty, that's through the different environmental backdrops, that's through, you know, some of the levels give you more freedom to explore, and some of them are a little more linear, although they're always, you know, some choices. Just trying to get across that mood so that, like, when you got to the game, even if you hadn't been hanging on every word of the cutscene, you'd still kind of get what was going on and get what was at stake. When you were finishing, when you kind of did your last things and made your last choice. And so that was really important. So that's my info dump on that, I guess.
Well, you know, you're a librettist, really. If you want to think of it, I mean, you're a librettist. You're Oscar Hammerstein. I mean, what you're doing, it sounds to me, as you describe it, is, you know, there's a story to be told. So yes, there's a story in you, but as you described how you responded to playing the game a lot and watching what was happening with him, the feel of it, you know, the aesthetics of it, how that fed into what you were doing. I mean, it really is like you're writing lyrics to this score in a way.
I think I think that's a really good way to look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, and not to understate Chris's contribution, like, yes, the rough beats of the story were there for sure. But Chris was like invaluable in helping us actually nail down that stuff, not just literally like the words that fall out of people's mouths, but exactly the stuff he was just saying, where it's like, you know, the tone and the atmosphere at all the levels. And that totally fed back into like what I was trying to do design-wise and what we were doing art-wise. Like it was the whole thing, like soup to nuts, was like iterative, involving everybody. And that, I think that's part of the reason why it ended up like as well as it did. Where it's just like, you know, there nothing was precious, really, right? Like, it was just
not at all.
You know, let's. It's ultimately, we know where we want to be. Is this getting us there as best as it could be? If not, how can we change it so that it is?
Yeah, absolutely. And all the feedback and just going over it. One interesting thing too about the libretto, like even in the cutscenes, which we tried to keep short, you know, we tried not to go on. There's definitely not like pages of exposition. There's not all these extraneous details. Like I was super into paring all that down as much as possible. And I was walking some people through the game and through the demo level and then into the first major cutscene. And it was really interesting, like when I was studying it carefully, how you're introduced and there's a wordless animation that shows the ninja in action. And he's breaking into some compound, he's after something, he kills a bunch of guards. And there's intercut with shots of him getting a tattoo. So the entire point of that is really, I mean, there's a lot of detail there, but like your impression is, oh, okay, I get who the ninja is, he's a badass. He has these tools. And there's some subtleties, but it's not like exposition. When you go into the demo, the first thing you hear is like, oh, you know, like Aura comes up and she says, hey, there's an alarm bell ringing, we gotta go. No explanation, no one sets you down and says, all right, look, here are the 10 things you need to know about the plot. It's very much, And this is something I've heard, like, Margaret Robertson gave a wonderful talk where she sort of said, like, when a player first starts, the first thing they're thinking is just, they're not thinking, like, what is my biography and who are my ancestors and what country am I in or any of that. They're thinking, like, where am I and what can I do? And, like, what am I after? So when you actually really watch through that first whole entire level, there's very little plot detail. You are introduced to the fact, like, oh, okay, well, the ninjas are us. We like us. These guys with guns are bad. They're them. We don't like them. You finish that, and by the end of that, the tutorial has kind of led you through first really holding your hand and gradually letting go as you learn how to do different abilities, and then you start making choices about, okay, here are two guards, how am I going to take them out, or do I want to sneak past them, you know, and then you get to the end. Then you get the beginning of the game proper. This is like, so after the demo, and everyone who tries the demo should then buy the game so that they can see this. You get into world. Yeah, you know, so the second level, you have a cutscene that's maybe like a minute or a minute and a half, easily the longest one in the game. And that's when they finally sit you down and explain the premise and explain there are these tattoos. We have a history with them. They help us when things are bad, but terrible things happen. And while that's going on, there's an amazing animation, like just this visually stunning, like kind of thing of like ink on parchment and these figures coming and going. And it like is really awesome to look at while you're being fed all this information. But what I found really striking is, yeah, like you don't get that premise until like a good half hour, 20 minutes to half an hour into the game, because it wouldn't matter until you really had started to step into the role of ninja and start to think about what that role meant to you. Meaning you've started to make choices about, I'm a ninja who kills people, or I'm a ninja who sneaks around and doesn't kill anyone, or I'm a ninja who's clumsy because I kind of suck at this, but I'm enjoying it anyway. And then we can kind of go from there. Mm-hmm.
It's sort of cool to think that the soaking in all of those GDC talks, you know, ultimately it can actually, you know, manifest itself in actual game design. It's actual.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's applicable. I think of Clay as a boutique studio, with what I see as sort of a house style. You know, in other words, sort of like a fashion designer or certain writers or filmmakers, you can easily see their fingerprints on the work they produce. And it's part of what makes them special. I wonder if you see your studio, Clay Entertainment, in that way, Nels.
I guess so. I mean, because I'm so like inured to how things look. For me, it's just like the most rote, like passe, whatever. It's the, we draw 2D stuff and it has nice animation. I guess sure. But like every once in a while, I get those like, you know, uncanny moments where I actually sort of like, you know, my eyes fuzz up or something, and then I realize that, like, oh yeah, Jesus Christ, a lot of this stuff does look really good. that is definitely like part of our DNA at this point, I guess, which is awesome.
Well, you have really, really good animators. I mean, when I was at E3, I was lucky because I mean, it would have been great to talk to you or Chris, of course, but actually, in the short time that I had to play with the game, what struck me then was the fluidity of the controls and the aesthetic quality of it, that there is an art style that's real keen. You know, it's a very particular look, and the animators, you know, with the layering that's happening visually on the screen, it's terrific. I mean, I love the way the game looks.
Yeah, I had nothing to do with that, so I don't feel like you're saying. I completely agree that, yeah, I love the way it looks as well.
Well, the animator I stood next to was, you know, it was clear to me that he was very, very proud of the work. That he wasn't like arrogant, but you know what I'm saying. I could tell that he just loved the fact that people were telling him all day long, "Wow, this game looks fantastic." You know.
Yeah, that was Aaron Boutier, our lead animator, and yeah, that's kind of the awesome thing about, like, I think every single person on the art team at Clay has in the past either worked on like feature animation or cartoon animation. And it totally shows, right? Because in general, I mean, not to disparage any particular studio, but you can definitely, there are games you can look at and it's like, oh, well, this art was made by people that make video game art, right? It's like, oh, I'm sure that guy's portfolio has a lot of tanks and maybe an orc in it. it's true, right? Like, and it's kind of unfortunate, but if you look at, you know, something else like Journey or whatever, like you know that all the artists on that, like, they're artists in like, they have far more breadth. Like, they actually care about art as a practice and not just art, like, as a product. And all of our animators and artists in general, like, they're all totally the same way. Where, like, they're very serious about the craft, but it's not, like, so domain specific that it's really, like, myopic and insular. Like, they are able to draw from broad influences, and that's awesome. It also means that conversationally I get kind of lost sometimes. But in general, like, it's awesome that they have that kind of like diversity is there, and I think that's a big part of the reason why the games sort of look the way they do, is that the people making them like have a broad suite of backgrounds, just in terms of their artistic interest, which is awesome. And so what I kind of wanted to do is, you know, definitely maintain that, but also like push the design front of what we want to do even more. And I think with the other game that Clay's working on right now, this like crazy like survival sim thing called Don't Starve, it also kind of has that, where like it looks very different, very specific, very stylized, but like design wise it's also crunchy and different and systemic and interesting, and that's awesome. And so if we can keep like pushing both of those fronts, so lordy, I'm gonna be happy.
Yeah, well, it's part of what I think makes game design right now at this time so interesting, that you know you look at how other media, there's very little discussion, it seems to me, that has any real bearing on the way something looks. I mean, if you're going to make the next Batman or Spider-Man movie or whatever, it's going to look a certain way, and so that's that. But nobody's pushing the envelope very much. You could maybe say, you know, what's the film? I can't remember that. Rush, something Rush. They're bike riders. They're messengers, guys in New York City. It's a movie that came out.
Oh, right, yeah. Did you see a really quick, the Beasts of the Southern Wild?
Yes, yeah.
Was made, and you know what else? And this is probably a super corny movie, but that Life of Pi movie. Have you seen the trailer for that?
I've seen the trailer for it. I immediately wanted to see it. I read, like, the book.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That was beautiful.
It's
beautiful.
But of course, you know, it's Ang Lee, so you figure. But there's I guess what I'm suggesting is that
they're very, very rare. They're the exceptions.
They are the exception, and it seems to me that we're kind of at this place where everybody has to sit down and say, okay, what do we want our art style to be for this game? And it could be anything. It could be, I mean, we're kind of all over the crazy map these days in this beautiful way. And like you say, Nels, I mean, obviously some games just seem to, we just gather the same people and kind of use the same assets with little variations. But there are a lot, especially in the indie game space, there's so many people who clearly are taking time before they actually get too far into the design process, where they're saying, what should this feel and look like? And I wish that more people would take the time to ask that question in other media.
Right. Yeah. I know what you're saying for sure. I think a big part of that is just like, you can't ever be comfortable with being comfortable, I guess, right? Where it's like, if you're ever just returning to stuff that works without ever really thinking about why and why it might want to be different or whatever, it's like that's a very dangerous road, right?
Yeah. So, Chris, I'm curious from your point of view. This isn't the first game you've worked on. You've done work in game on the game design side and the writing for games, but I'm curious to know how this process affects your thinking about the game development process. Maybe you've sort of functioned as a critic and as a journalist for so long.
Right. I mean, I definitely know a zillion times more than I ever did before. And I think everyone should try to make a game. I think I probably knew less than a lot of game journalists, because the people who work like day in and day out at it and spend a lot of time with studios, I think they do get a good look at it, but it is just inevitably different to be, you know, you're privileged to be in a position where you can see really early builds and a lot of them, and where you can kind of be involved and have those conversations. And it definitely feels like kind of the other side of the fence a bit. You know, I think I've learned a lot just because I've been so involved in this project. Is a lot, like I said, I mean, a lot of writers just file the script and then that's kind of it, and then they don't hear about it. And, you know, you hear stories of games where, like, you know, they wrote all this extra dialogue and it just sort of got cut. They never had a chance to, like, work something in and they feel like half the plot that they prepared was gone or something like that. It's like that wasn't, you know, this was a lot more collaborative. I don't know, though. It's like it's so broad. It's like it's interesting because one thing I don't feel like doing now is I wouldn't feel right trying to go back and do game reviews or try to do interviews as a journalist. I mean, I'm definitely, I feel like once you're kind of tainted with that, you can't go back to journalism, which should be a kind of a pure state. At the same time, you know, I'd be interested in writing about games for things like, you know, Gamma Sutra or something. If I knew more, now I'm sort of aware of how little I know. But it's definitely another side of the fence, I guess, would be a way to... I've learned a lot more, and it's sort of, I'm in a different world.
Yeah.
One of us.
Yeah. I mean, and it makes me really, eager to do more, learn more game design, like do more hobby projects or something, or get involved in more different kind of experiences. My other major gig was the Carmen San Diego for Facebook game, and really all I did for that was write location clues and tons of location clues. And I think we did have one story meeting early on, and I remember like Rob Dubin had some really good ideas for story, and like we threw some things around, but as I remember, I don't think the game ever really had a plot when we were involved in it. It just was kind of like you just went around solving cases. So it was just a matter of writing tons and tons of location clues. So actually having something to connect those things together on this game was a lot better.
Yeah.
It was a more interesting experience.
How many people worked on the game approximately?
Yeah, so I was answering this in another context earlier today. We were all trying to remember. So for the first 9 months, it was basically seven people. Myself, three artists, and three programmers. And then when Chank 2 finished, we picked up a whole bunch of extra folks to kind of get us over the hill, right? And at that point, I think the apex was like probably 14. Plus folks like Jamie and Jeff, who obviously were super, super, super involved, but also just kind of had more broad, like, running the whole studio duties as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that big, especially considering how...
Yeah. That's it.
Might as well be on an episode of Idle Thumbs. But yes, so it was eight for about half of the time, and then 14 for like the other half ish, which given the size of the game is actually not that many people at all.
Yeah, that's what I want to ask you: is what are the virtues of being small, and is it, you know, at a certain point, if you'd said, "Hey, look, I can throw you 10 more people," would you like them? Would you said yes or
no? No, definitely not.
Okay,
because like just the like. Especially when you're trying to build something that isn't really very familiar, right? Like if you're building, you know, a relatively by the numbers first person shooter, like you can just kind of throw a mountain of bodies at that. And more or less from the outset, probably everyone who's played a video game is gonna know what that thing is, right? But if you're trying to build something that's kind of different, something that doesn't really exist, like a 2D stealth game, getting everyone on the same page, like with what we're trying to achieve, you know, in terms of the atmosphere and the tone and all that is challenging just because like, oh, this thing doesn't exist. We can't point at it and say, hey, a thing like that. So the more people you have, it's just the more like lines of, like, I'm sure you guys have all seen that graph, right? Where it's like, oh, the more people you add, the more lines of communication, and the thing just blows up like exponentially or even like super exponentially. And so the more people you have, just the harder that stuff is. And then you can't really do this iterative stuff because you have so many people. And then it's like, oh, God, well, we spent 2 days on that thing. That's 2 days of like 15 people's time. So can we get rid of that? I don't know. Having a smaller amount of people where you can just really be focused and iterate, and it's really easy to be conversational and stuff. Like I don't ever want to not do that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think... people from the outside looking in probably think a lot about game reviews, Metacritic, all the things that happen after a game is released, and sales figures and all the things. Do you think about that stuff very much? I mean, obviously, there's a pressure to succeed.
Yeah, I mean, you can't not. Like, you obviously, I don't think anyone can ever completely divorce that stuff from your mind. But it's yeah, it's like really more what's maybe producing like a little bit of anxiety is just like the game, because it is kind of different and because of some other very specific decisions we made, like we have to trust the audience a lot, right? And I think it is absolutely the right thing to do, and I wish more games would do it. But like there are things that are kind of different and kind of subtle, right? There isn't this giant golden line leading you straight to the end. We're not leading you by the hand saying, all right, do this here and do this there. And didn't you have a great time looking at this stuff? And so because of that, like, you just sort of have to have faith that the folks out there kind of want something like that, and that they want to find it interesting and different. And really, that, again, coming back to that self-serving thing I meant earlier, I'm like, well, I hope people do, because those are the kind of things that I want, and I want there to be more of them. And so if folks like find this thing interesting, that's very enlivening and edifying, right? Not necessarily specifically because of the thing we did is awesome, but more broadly, it's like, oh, things like this are stuff that people think are great, and you know, there will be more of them. I mean, like, ultimately, of course, though, right? Like, if you work really hard on a thing, you want people to like it.
Sure.
Well, you know, one thing is that we've had some validation about, like, and I don't mean like review scores or anything, but the people getting the concept. First of all, that a lot of the previews that have come out since over the last few months, it's been interesting to see you talking to people about the stealth and about how it works, and people really get it, latching onto that and describing, mm-hmm. you know, how that problem is solved and how that works in the game. And the other thing is seeing the way people play and hearing them say stuff like, you know, I kept going back, I kept trying it again and again because I really wanted to get it right. I didn't want to get caught. I didn't want to have these mistakes. I really wanted to get it perfect. But it's also interesting to note that there are a lot of really deliberate things that you guys did to encourage certain kinds of behavior. So one is, you know, you said like the checkpoints are super forgiving. There are tons of checkpoints in every level because it's so it's never an issue of like, I don't want to just like not, I have to be so careful because if I fuck up, I'm going to have to repeat half the level. So that gives people more room to experiment. And the other thing that I find really, you know, you guys have a really good sense of like points and really of scoring things and sort of like the seals that are in every level. So every level you get like three kind of optional goals. And there's, correct me if I'm wrong, it's like generally like one of them is more stealthy, one of them is more violent, like sneaking and killing a certain number of people, and one of them is more like moving quickly, like get through the first part of this level in 1 minute. And every level has different ones. And so, you know, you notice they're there, you start to aspire to them because people are like that, they're wired to do that. And they lead you into different types of play. Like either to like looking more carefully for all the, like there's one where like you have to get three guard dogs to sniff you, which is kind of hilarious. you know, but there are other ones where it's like, you know, there'll be a seal for like, it was either a seal or an achievement for like, you know, use one guard's body to terrorize another guard, or use a dead body to lure someone down a hallway and trap them, or what. You know, there are like really specific behaviors that you guys are calling out and saying, hey, can you do this? And that teaches people to think about, you know, oh yeah, I haven't tried doing that before. I haven't tried to terrorize anyone yet. So there, you know, there's a lot of, you know, not too heavy-handed stuff that encourages and teaches those different play styles. I mean, I'll also say, like, the hardest, I remember Jamie saying this too, that first tutorial level is really difficult, and a lot of work, right, went into making sure that, like, things were explained well. And I think that even when you get to the end of it, you don't fully understand all the things that are at your disposal yet. But at least it's enough that you can function and then kind of learn from there. But I think that the learning curve is as gentle as it can possibly be. But throughout the game, you know, there are a lot of encouragements to try different things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was obviously definitely on purpose.
Yeah.
One of the things in my business that you can do, and I know a lot of people do it, it's sort of shameless, is a director might mosey through the lobby during intermission or at the end and just kind of catch what people are saying.
Really?
People know who the director is of a production. You know, you can be standing right next to people who are just trashing the production and they don't know you're the director. And yeah. So you can hear it. And sometimes you'll hear someone say something that's just deeply gratifying. That it's like they got it. You know, like the most important thing you were trying to accomplish, they picked up on it and it just feels fantastic. And I'm curious what would that be for you? if somebody you overheard somebody talking about the game?
Well, at least for me, it actually kind of happened. Just before we were running up to CERT, we had like a few people come and like play the entire game through because we really wanted to just do a little bit more playtesting on the later game levels. And we had a buddy of mine, like I sent him home with a build, he played through most of it, and then we just had him come back into the office for like the last, you know, 3 or 4 levels, whatever it was. And completely unbidden, without any sort of prompting at all, he said, well, I really like this because it always feels like whenever I do something, there were a bunch of other things I could have done that would have worked just as well. And I'm like, that is exactly what I wanted. Like, that is precisely what I wanted this, like, player-centric, you know, heavily choice-based gameplay to be like. And then when he said that, I was like, yeah, that's pretty sweet. Maybe it is working.
Yeah, good. And I can understand that. I've played it. I think I've not seen the new ending that you have, right? I think that's...
Yes.
The build. You guys were kind enough to send me a build a while back, so I totally get why that would be... Why he would say that, because it's clearly probably the most important thing about the game. Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Chris?
I've been watching to see, and you know, it's funny because even now it's just the people who have advanced codes. You can see them on Raptor and see which achievements people have gotten and like, you know, how far they're playing through. So I'm like avidly like watching all this. And the interesting thing is I think, and people I've spoken with have gotten maybe through the first couple worlds, and I'm really eager to see what they think of the later stuff, because that's the stuff that hasn't really been the trailers and some of the art and some of the environmental. I have to like name check Megan Shaw, who led the environmental artist team, because it's just gorgeous stuff, and it goes in some strange places, and some really wonderful, strange, different things happen later on. And I'm just hoping that people, I'm just curious to see what people make of all that and make of you know, the tone the whole way through. And because, you know, it's interesting, like one of the things that I've done as a writer and as a journalist, I definitely was a little more focused on sort of like the story type of stuff and content and themes, and more like, you know, what is the message of this and stuff. And I really feel like I wasn't as mature about the mechanics, and I wasn't as observant about kind of the underlying gameplay. And something I really want to do now is just as a writer is try to really learn how to write interesting stuff about just the most gnarly game mechanics of like how that stuff works and what effect that has. And you know, so I definitely wasn't paying it. So now I'm like much more aware of it and paying more attention to it, but I'm still aware of the role of like the theming, you know, of the art and the story and the plot and the ending to just sort of like that. I don't think it's decisive in a game, but it's like in the way the gameplay is if the gameplay sucks, no one will finish it, right? It won't hook you. It won't make you assume that role and feel what that's about. But like, that's kind of the stuff that sticks to your ribs. And I'm hoping that, you know, that kind of comes through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm sure both of you guys read that piece that Kirk wrote over on Kotaku about how like, you know, games and story are like music and lyrics, right? Where obviously you don't need lyrics to have a fantastic piece of music, but in certain contexts, when those two things are put together, you know, they so grossly exceed the sum of their parts. And it's like, yeah, I totally think that is the case.
I think the story elements will surprise people because it you could easily imagine the description of the game is it's a stealth platformer, it's a ninja, it's all, you know, whatever enters your mind there. There, you talked about tone. I think the storytelling and the art style and all of that it's decisive in terms of how the game communicates the tone, but also, you know, it's actually the story goes places that you don't expect it to. It's not formulaic at all. In fact, you know, from my perspective, it's it's a little audacious in a way, given that you're working with what would be apparently formulaic stuff. You know, I mean, it's a game with ninjas, right? But you guys really ring some interesting changes on that formula, in my opinion. I guess I can't say too much because people won't give anything away.
Well, that's great to hear, and I think that, I mean, because it certainly would have been sufficient to have ninja go up against a bad guy and then another bad guy and then another bad guy on top of that, and that's kind of a winning, enduring formula. But I like that, and it has always been set up from the get-go to be something bolder and a little stranger and maybe a little darker. And I think that that works well. But I think it also works well with who the character is, because it, I mean, it all has to make sense. But, you know, we talked a lot about that this ninja is very powerful, but also very vulnerable. And like Nels was at the beginning was sort of like introducing me the glass cannon idea. And I think the story is sort of set up and the moods of the tone of it are set up to reinforce that, to make you feel like that you are sort of out on your own, that you have these problems, you have this sort of tragic thing hanging over you from the beginning of the game, but that you're also sort of super powerful and stuff. And so if it can reinforce both those things, then that makes the character more compelling than if he's just like total flying ninja banshee badass guy.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And that was the thing that we definitely, like, I wanted to achieve. And Chris helped a ton with that. And so, I mean, so did everybody else on the team, right? And I think I like to imagine we kind of got there, more or less, I hope.
Well, people will have the chance to be their own judges when the game comes out. So, and
that's right.
It comes out in hours. When this podcast is released, it'll probably be available on XBLA. And will there be other platforms, Nels, for players?
Yeah, we would definitely like to do a PC version as well. We're still sorting out like all the details for that, but I don't think people have to worry about that too much.
Great. Well, I want to thank both of you for your time, and you know, I really appreciate the fact that you're willing to, on a night when you probably ought to be just like taking it easy and kicking up your feet because this thing is finally done, take the time to chat with me. I'm grateful, and I wish you all the best with the game.
Oh yeah, no, this is awesome. Like I can't imagine a better way to spend the night before launch. No joke.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I just have to give you a shout out, Michael, that you know that the reason I was able to get involved with this at all was because you had us, as well as Gus Pastrapa, out to dinner at GDC last year, and in Chinatown, and we were all sitting around the table, and that was when Nels mentioned that he was on, you know, special project, he was going to be helming it, and because I knew that, I sort of shot him a line later and was like, hey, you know, if you, because it's not like I'm like on the market, it's not like I have some rep who goes around and like sells me to be a writer to people, you know, I just sort of am like sending these like shy little emails, like, I'd really like to work on your game. And I wouldn't have known that Clay was up to anything like this, but, you know, because we were all having dinner and stuff. So without you, the game totally would have happened. I wouldn't have been involved in it. It would have been someone from Hollywood who had worked on the Transformers movie. Who knows? It could have been David Mamet. You know, they might have got really lucky, but it worked out for me.
I'm glad.
Yeah, I forgot about that. That's totally true. So thanks, Michael, for helping us make a sweet game possible.
Hey, you know, I'm just a matchmaker. I'm glad you mentioned Gus, too. Anyone listening, if you're not familiar with Gus Mastropa's work, you should definitely check it out. He's one of the preeminent writers about games and other things. And by the way, we're trying to figure out a way to make this happen, but I think Gus is going to come to Wabash, if we can work it out, just like Chris did last year, and talk to the students here about writing and about career as a writer. And
sweet. You know,
yeah, it's great to also just have people. There are a lot of people that in this sphere of critics and designers and all that we kind of hang around with, who just seem to have a love for sharing what they know. And you know, Dennis Farr, whom I think you guys know, who is coming back.
Oh yeah, he's coming back.
Yeah, he's going to talk.
Oh sweet.
Too. So, you know, this kind of work where people reach out and talk to young, budding, interested students about their work is just hugely important to me, and I think you know, to a lot of people. So appreciate you guys being willing to do that kind of stuff.
Oh, that's going to be awesome! I might have to fly out just to attend that.
Yeah, I know. He'll have a big fan club when he leaves, I'm sure. But we haven't set up. We just talked about it briefly, and we haven't got any details. But when details are available, I'll let people know. And yeah, people are free to come and visit and see him talk too. Once we get that worked out with dates, I need to get back in touch with him. So,
sweet.
Yeah. Well, get some rest, guys. You're off to Ireland, right, Nels?
Yep. Ireland and Scotland for 2 weeks on Tuesday. So it's basically release a video game, smoke bomb. I'm out. Enjoy it, guys. I'll see you later.
Great. Well, have a great trip. And
thank you.
Safe travels, man.
Yeah, I'm stoked.
All right. Well, thanks again, gentlemen, and I hope we can talk again soon.
Of course. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you.